Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, the new and anti-penultimate Harry Potter film. I'm here with Dan Coyce. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dana.
Who we may now say is the Washington Post film critic.
A Washington Post film critic
and a contributor to the New York magazine culture blog, The Vulture.
Correct.
Or just Vulture, I guess, right? You don't do the article.
They'll edit this out later, but yeah.
Okay. So we're coming into this totally fresh. I want you here in the studio with me, actually, which is very nice to see you, by the way.
It's because, fun not to just be in Washington talking to you over an ISDN line.
Right, with a video hookup. But I wanted you here because you're the resident Potterphile of Slate, and I think you've spoiled all the previous Harry Potter movies that have...
I have, and when the last Harry Potter book came out, I ran a week-long spoiler special book club on the last Harry Potter book as well. So yes.
You've done your share of Harry Potter spoiling.
I've marked my territory in the Harry Potter world at Slate.
Well, in that case, I want you to take it away. I mean, I saw from your review that you and I somewhat have opposite takes on the movie. I mean, for one thing, you liked it more than I did. But also, you made a claim that I sort of feel like I felt the opposite. You thought that this was a movie for non-book files. That, in other words, if you're not a Harry Potter head, this is going to be the best Harry Potter movie for you. Right. I, on the other hand, felt like it was very inside baseball, inside Quidditch, and that without having read the books, there's a lot of jargon and lingo flying around that I couldn't really follow. And mind you, I've seen all the movies and liked them for the most part.
Right. Well, I guess my qualification on my claim that this is the best Harry Potter movie for people who haven't read the books is if you don't care too much about paying attention. I mean, if you are actually trying to figure out everything, you will then be frustrated because a great deal goes unexplained in this movie. But if you're willing to just sit back and enjoy the teen romance and action sequences and the jokes, you'll probably have a pretty good time. So let's spoil it. So this is the sixth movie based on the sixth book. There are seven books in total. The seventh book will be turned into two movies, as Dana implied.
Which is a decision they made fairly recently, right? I mean, I know when I wrote on the last movie, I thought there was just one to go, not two to go.
Yeah, about a year ago they made that decision to do that. A decision that would have, honestly, as a Potterphile, would have been fine with me pretty much with every movie. I would have been perfectly happy with two movies based on any of the last couple of books. But so this one picks up the story as the war against Voldemort, the Dark Lord, is well underway between Harry Potter and his friends and Voldemort and the Death Eaters, who are his followers. Harry Potter's just lost his godfather, Sirius Black, who was killed by a follower of Voldemort. And he returns to school for his sixth year with a mission. The mission is sort of twofold. It's a mission that Dumbledore, the headmaster of Hogwarts, gives him. It's one, to learn more about Voldemort, about the opponent who he presumably will one day face. And the second is to tease a memory out of the new potions master, Horace Slughorn, who's played by Jim Broadbent in this movie, who is a former Hogwarts teacher who was once a teacher of Tom Riddle, the boy who grew up to be Voldemort. And once upon a time, Tom Riddle asked Horace Slughorn a very important question and one that holds a key to possibly defeating him, but Dumbledore has not been able to find out what that question was, and he employs Harry and a connection that Harry and Slughorn develop in order to try and weasel that memory out. It turns out what the memory is that Voldemort, young Voldemort, Tom Riddle, Lil Voldemort, as I call him, asked Horace Slughorn about a piece of magic called a Horcrux, which is a way in which a wizard can split his soul into two or more pieces, basically vouchsafing a piece of his soul in an object of some kind, so that even if his body is killed, his soul will exist somewhere so he could be resurrected.
And question, is the Horcrux something that we're supposed to have known about at this point? And when you're reading the books, is this something that appears for the first time?
It's a brand new piece of magic.
Because I knew it was brand new to the movies, and right. You know, I felt like it was sort of inadequately explained by this movie, which was another of the inside Quidditch
movies. Right, well, I mean, but what are you going to do? It basically takes an entire chapter to explain the concept of a Horcrux in the
book. And there's a lot of conceptual magic in the books that obviously can't be shoehorned into the movies.
So at the end of the movie, Dumbledore informs Harry that he's located one of the seven Horcruxes in which Voldemort has secreted away parts of his soul and sets off with Harry to destroy it. They end up in a cavern on the English coast where they find the Horcrux. Dumbledore is weakened in the effort. They travel back to Hogwarts. Dumbledore is killed. Oh, spoiler alert. Also, we're going to be spoiling this in our spoiler special. Dumbledore is killed by Severus Snape, the professor at Hogwarts, who's whose reliability and truthfulness Harry has always doubted.
I have a question about Snape, but should we wait till you finish?
And I'll finish. There's not that much. And then so Dumbledore dies and everyone's sad. And Harry discovers that what he thought was the Horcrux they were saving was, in fact, a fake. The Horcrux had been found sometime before by someone with the mysterious initials R.A.B.
And so Dumbledore died for nothing.
And so Dumbledore died for nothing in Harry's eyes, yes.
And we haven't even gotten to the romantic stuff. We'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
A good three quarters of the movie is not spent on anything you just described, but just on sort of teen romance. Well, here's my Snape question while I'm remembering it. So at this point, once again, I rely on your arcane Harry Potter knowledge. We don't know if Severus Snape, played by Alan Rickman wonderfully in the movie, it's the best performance in this movie, I think. We don't know if he's a double agent or not, right?
We do not know. I mean, the best performance in the entire series by far. It's... every time he's on the screen, it makes me so happy, even though the character is a pretty conflicted character and one of my favorite characters in the books. But yes, at this point in the books and in the movies, we do not know. We have seen and heard Severus Snape proclaim fealty to the side of good, to the side of Dumbledore and the Order of the Phoenix and Harry Potter, though he clearly does not like Harry Potter at all. And we have seen him swear fealty to the side of evil, to Voldemort, to other Death Eaters. And we do not know which side he's truly on.
Or indeed what motivation he would have for spying for either side.
Right. Correct.
Right. So that makes the next chapter seem juicy to me, which is a strange thing about this movie that I didn't particularly like it, but I still can't wait to see the next two chapters.
There's a lot of stuff to be uncovered, and some of it is very satisfying, and in the books at least, and some of it is somewhat unsatisfying. I would say the reasons behind Snape and his story are fairly satisfying, I thought, given that he's my favorite character and his story ended in one of the ways that I hoped it would end. But that's for 2 years from now.
Right. Yeah, that's going to have to dangle there for some time. Do you want to at all get into the sort of book versus movie question as far as, like, what relation does this series, which has now been going on for 8 years of movies, bear to the huge following and readership that the books have? I mean, most Harry Potter fans seem to be following the movies as well and excited about them. Is there some contingent of people that just think that the movies don't do justice to the books and kind of reject them out of hand?
I don't know if there's a contingent. I assume there's a contingent of people who do everything. I assume there's a contingent of people who are angry that Dobby isn't in every movie. But, my feelings on the movies have always sort of been that I'm a rabid enough fan of the book that I would be perfectly happy, as I said in my review in the Post, I would be perfectly happy, honestly, if the Harry Potter movies came out in 30-hour BBC miniseries in which people just literally said every line that was in the book.
Right. I mean, don't you say in your review that may be the ideal format in which to experience
Harry Potter? It certainly would be my ideal format in which to experience it, but I recognize that that is neither commercially likely nor probably actually an aesthetically successful way to adapt a work. It's just what I want.
Right.
Fan.
As it happens, though, I mean, the sort of, you know, BBC, the lengthy BBC literary adaptation miniseries has done some great stuff in the past.
Right.
I mean, maybe that's just sort of, you know, if you've got an English novel you love, you just need to slap it up in a BBC miniseries.
So I just basically I'm hoping I stay alive long enough so that 40 years from now when the BBC gets the rights back, I'll still be around. At that time, I'm sure I'll view it as a shame that this cast, which is fantastic, pretty much up and down the line, we're not the ones who got to do my 30-hour faithful.
So you don't
version.
Have any disappointments with the ongoing cast of these movies?
Not really. I mean, I would say actually really my only disappointment, and one that I didn't go into a lot in the review, but one that which is crucial to this movie and leads me to a question I have for you, is Michael Gambon as Dumbledore. You know, he replaced Richard Harris after the second movie when Richard Harris passed away.
Right.
And it's obviously a crucial character for the movie. And so much of the emotion of this particular chapter of the story revolves around Harry's feelings toward Dumbledore and Dumbledore's feelings toward Harry. And I've always had a real problem with the way Gambon played the role.
Is that just because you liked Richard Harris so much that you didn't want him to be
I didn't really like Richard Harris. Richard Harris was fine. He was better, I thought, than Gambon, but I didn't love him either, mostly because he just seemed really old and creaky and like he never could do any of the things that Dumbledore could do. But Michael Gambon plays Dumbledore really shouty and angry, and he just yells a lot. And more sort of to the point, he lacks any sense of whimsy, which to me has always been the thing that has made Dumbledore a character who I understand why children love him. Not just children in the audience, but children in the world of Harry Potter.
Right. You mean he's got more of a sort of a goofiness? Or
yeah,
tenderness?
A goofiness. There's, you know, I just rewatched all the Harry Potter movies while reviewing this one and while working on another feature for New York Magazine.
Oh, because you were going to rank all of them in order.
Right, because I ranked all of them in order. And I had forgotten about a scene in the very first Harry Potter movie in which Richard Harris is Dumbledore, while Harry is in the hospital wing, gives this great little bit, which is straight out of the book, but which is very adorable, in which he says, you know, ah, Bertie Bott's every flavor beans, or the jelly beans that are every flavor in the world. And he talks about how he once in his youth was unlucky enough to be handed a vomit-flavored one, but perhaps he'll give them another try. And he pops one in his mouth and says, alas, earwax. And that's the kind of, like, sort of just, like, very charming and non-serious note that has sort of disappeared.
It is
from
actually
Dumbledore.
Hard to imagine Michael Gambon saying alas, earwax.
And Michael Gambon has a lot of energy, and he's very sprightly in the role, and you can buy him as a powerful wizard in a way that you maybe couldn't buy Richard Harris, but you can't buy him as someone who Harry loves. And you certainly don't have any sense, I don't think, if you haven't read the books. And this is the question I wanted to ask you. Do you get the impression that Dumbledore really, really cares for Harry? As an extension, how moved were you or were you not by Dumbledore's death at the end of the movie?
Right. Yeah, that is a huge question to ask someone who's not a bookophile. I mean, I think I was basically as moved as the movie without the book factored in wanted me to be, mm-hmm. you know? And maybe that's part of why this movie left me cold, is that that is an inside baseball moment where you have to bring in the character development that you have in J.K. Rowling and you don't have in David Yates' film version. But I had to import a little bit of feeling. In fact, essentially when I watched, I never saw any flaws in Gambon's performance per se, but I can't say that it strikes me as an electrifying one. And I couldn't help always but measure him against a great wizard performance on film, which is Ian McKellen in the Lord of the Rings movies, who obviously brings, I think, a lot more sort of tenderness and richness to the role.
Yes, and there are a lot of, I thought, attempts to make Dumbledore as Gandalf-y as possible in this. I mean, right down to like the underground battle and him opening a door with his hand and magic and the stone, which is very obviously Lord of the Rings-ish, but also just there was a McKellian sort of spring to his step, I thought, in this movie, and there were a lot of attempts to give him like that swirling, action-packed fighting style that Gandalf has in the Lord of the Rings movies, which is not really something we'd seen from Dumbledore before,
right?
In this one, but
in general, I think these movies don't quite know what to do with action sequences, and maybe we can get to that in a minute because I want to take a break for a word from our sponsor.
Oh yes, our sponsor.
So, as regular listeners know, the Slate Podcasts now have a great deal with Audible.com, which is the leading provider of audiobooks on the web. Where if you sign up through our page, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, you can get a free audiobook with your membership. And you get to keep the book even if you don't remain a member, which I guarantee you will want to. So our recommendation in connection with this book, Dan just suggested and reminded me that the great British actor Jim Dale reads all the Harry Potter books in audio. You can get them all on Audible, but we'll recommend the next one so that you're ready for the next 2 summers worth of Harry Potter movies.
It's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Deathly Hallows, read by Jim Dale. Mm. So get on Audible and take a look. All right, so let's get back to what was my complaint?
Action sequences.
Action sequences. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true in this movie, which has very, very, even you as a fan of this movie, have to admit it has very little action over the running time. It sort of all comes in a clump in the last, you know, 1/6 of the movie or something.
Right. The only previous action in the movie was in fact inserted for the movie. That scene in which Bellatrix Lestrange and that other dude attack the Weasleys' house is not in the book at all. And it seems clear that at some point someone in Hollywood said, we can't have the only action sequence in this movie be in the last 10 minutes. And so they added it. There's a scene in this movie which will come as a great surprise to people who have read the books, in which Bellatrix Lestrange and Fenrir Greyback, who fans of the book will know who he is, but people who watch the movie will have no clue that that is who that character is meant to be. He's
the David Thewlis character?
No, he's the other vampire, the other werewolf who attacks the Weasley's house along with Bellatrix Lestrange. They right in the middle of the Christmas holidays in the movie, they attack the Weasley's house, the Burrow. They almost get Harry and Ginny, and they, in fact, burn the house to the ground, which for fans of the book will lead them to wonder, well, where will all the scenes that occur at the Burrow in the 7th book occur? But who knows?
So that's maybe a change they'll have to make in the next 2 movies as well.
It's magic. They can just rebuild it in 5 minutes, I guess.
But it shows you how little narrative function that scene had that I completely forgot about it in my assessment of the movie. I sort of wanted a lot more Helena Bonham Carter than we got. But mm-hmm. anyway, so my action critique would be, I think that this has to do with, you know, the adaptation problem. Obviously, Lord of the Rings is an adaptation too, but a much, much more condensed one. I mean, Harry Potter movies really, truly are taking one book and sort of trying to get its entire story on the screen. And I feel like in the name of getting all this exposition across and all this character development and all this romance in the case of this movie, that, you know, they do sort of forget that we go to movies like this to watch stuff happen and, you know, people face each other with various magic wands and weapons or whatever.
Right. And the action sequences have never been a real specialty of this series. I mean, there have been a couple of really good action sequences in the six movies, but I would say that in this movie, they continue the problem they've always had, which is that people pointing wands at each other and shouting is not, like, inherently dramatic.
Right, no yelling Latin phrases.
Right, no matter how many jets of green light you shoot at each other, or it's no matter what you do, they have not found a way to make those either seem dangerous or real in any real way, which is a problem considering that I don't think it will be a big shock to you to know that there's a gigantic magic fight at the end of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. And so I think I have a great deal of worry that that's just going to play very poorly.
Abracadabra, take that.
Right. It's like, I mean, how many times can you show people yelling Avada Kedavra at each other and people just barely almost being hit by the spell? Which is quite a lot of the action of the last part of the last book. But yeah, it is a real problem. And the action sequences that the movies have tended to do the best with are the ones I have found that that involve flying or that involve gigantic, awesome, magical creatures of the sort that are better in movies than they are in books. Because the dragon, for example, in the fourth movie, the dragon that Harry fights in the Triwizard Tournament was way awesomer in the movie than I ever even imagined it as I was reading the book. Whereas people pointing wands at each other is never awesomer in the movie than it was when I read the book.
Yeah, the impression I have from the movies in general is that there aren't too many moments that they probably make things happen cinematically that couldn't have happened on the page. That it's more of a sort of wand attempt to recreate some kind of magic that's happening on the page. And right. I should also say that my current relationship to the Harry Potter books is I'm waiting till my daughter's old enough to want to read them, and then we'll read them together. Why should I read them now when I'll have to read them all out loud right. repeatedly over the next few years?
You just saved like 150 hours of your life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these books are huge tomes. I'm not going to read them more times than I have to, but who knows, maybe I'll read them and fall completely in love. Okay, well, Dan, thanks so much for joining me on the spoiler that only you could have done with me as well as you did. Please join me again on the next spoiler special.
I'll see you in the fall of 2010 when Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, Harry, Hermione, and Ron Go Camping Forever comes out.
And well before that, I hope, as well. Okay, for Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.